Les séminaires du Collège de France.
Nous allons procéder de la manière suivante, c'est-à-dire que Chao Zhang va d'abord, et je pense que ce sera l'essentiel de la séance, reprendre en détail l'analyse des passages chinois. Donc, cette fois-ci, ce sera concentré sur les premières conquêtes des Yue Qi. Bon, la semaine dernière, c'était sur une présentation du nouveau système chronologique de Kuwayama et les critiques qu'on peut lui adresser. Là, ce sera sur l'ensemble des textes chinois qui sont donc le Hanshu et le Ru Hanshu, sur les premières conquêtes des Yue Qi. Et puis, j'interviendrai à la fin sur quelques points particuliers de toponymie, de bibliographie. Et l'information qu'on a, la très rare information qu'on a sur des rapports entre les premiers couchants et les Parthes qui peuvent aider à faire à caler la chronologie. Et ensuite, il y aura un développement assez long sur la question fondamentale du deuxième roi couchant, donc Vimataktou alias Sotermegas, dossier extrêmement complexe mais qui a énormément évolué récemment. Ça, je ne sais pas si j'aurai le temps d'en parler aujourd'hui, ce sera probablement principalement pour la séance suivante.
Oui.
Donc, Ching, it's for you to speak.
So, thank you. Aujourd'hui, on continue à lire les sources chinoises. Donc, oui, la première partie plus courte sur les lamelles et tablettes en bois, et pour la deuxième partie sur le Hohanshu. So, let's start. Last week, we ended with an explication to Kuwayama's chronological theory, and I think I had at least made one of my comments clear to you, that we don't have to count the concept of more than 100 years so strictly. That's to say, although Kuwayama's calculation is theoretically possible with regard to classical Chinese reading, more evidence has to be found to corroborate his theory. Since some of you are interested in the content of the wooden tablets here, these two, I shall explain what they say today. In 2004, Zhang Defang published a paper on the Chinese wooden slips excavated from Xuanquan sites, which attests the contact between the Han Dynasty and the Kangju, including Sogdiana, so as well as the Han's contact with the Dayuezhi. For convenience, you can perceive the center of Dayuezhi as the plain of Amudarya, the river flowing to between the Tajikistan, Afghanistan, and Uzbekistan. We have treated the ones about the Han-Kangju relationship in 2022. But the same paper also published 17 slips which attest Dayuezhi as the name of the kingdom. Two of them even attest the title Shihou, and fortunately, both with a clearly written date here, as I will explain. So, these two slips, so read in this paper, was used by Franz Kernet in his paper in 2006, and then also by Kuwayama for his theory of the five Yabus in 2017. But in fact, in 2014, during an international conference in China on Sogdians, proceedings published in 2016, Zhang Defang revised his wooden slip reading on the ones about Dayuezhi spatially. And recently, with the aid of infrared image scanning, he again improved his reading a little bit and authorized me to publish and translate it into English for the volume Le Kushan World edited by Joe Cripp and his colleagues. That is coming soon. So, Since I have introduced the environment of the site 2 years ago, I don't repeat it today, but please remind that the Xuanquan site, here, a little icon in purple, is near today's Dunhuang. It was one of the post stations to receive foreign envoys after they crossed the imperial border. Here and here, there are two gates. And it was close to the seat of the Dunhuang Commandery here in pink, and also the Dunhuang County. That is to say, the Xuanquan site was not a border station, but one of the stations inside the territory of the province. If you are interested in knowing more about the territory, you can consult this book, The Dynasty Qin Yihan, published in 2017. Here I just give you an impression on the location of Dunhuang here in pink, and location of Chang'an, the capital of the empire of the Western Han Dynasty. So let's see the slip, which reads the Da Yue Zhi Shuang Mi Xi Hou, the Shuang Mi Xi Hou of the Great Yue Zhi, or the second Xi Hou of the Da Yue Zhi according to Fox's terminology. And I translate Bo and Sheng Zhong, these are two Chinese officers, both being scribes of the Deputy Right General and undertaking a diplomatic mission to the Great Yue Zhi. Now they are coming back and bring Wan Ruo, envoy of the Shuang Mi Xi Hou of the Great Yue Zhi, and Su Lai, deputy envoy of the state of another state called Shanguo, and literally mountainous state, with them, with these two Chinese officers. And these two foreign envoys both bring tribute and have something to report at the place of the emperor. Please prepare a vehicle driven by 4 horses according to the law. And this is a request. And I can add one more note that according to Kuwayama, he suggests to resegment this text that maybe this Shan is not the name of a state, but part of the name of the envoy is Wan Ruo Shan. And if his view is correct, then we only have one envoy and one deputy envoy, both from the Shuang Mi Xi Hou of the Great Yue Zhi. And I won't explain too much, but actually 2 theories are possible. And this is the governor's decision that is written in the lower part of this wooden tablet. And I translate, in the first year of Yongguang, blah, 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 very long formulae of the date, and it is equal to 12 May 43 BCE, the governor of Dunhuang named Tian Qiu, the chief clerk named Zhang, and the head of granary named Guang, who performs the affair of the governor's aide. After receiving the above quest, command the whole commandery as so. The vehicle should be prepared for every section of their journey, as well as the food supply and accommodation service from one station to another station, as the law stand. Actually, this phrase is very short, but it's an abbreviation of a long but fixed expression, so we know what is the full text. And then there is one more additional line that on the Bing Wu day of the 4th month of that year, that means 16th May, they passed our station and traveled eastward. So, note that actually some of these officers, Chinese officers, were exactly the ones who proceed the request from the Kangju envoys that we treat 2 years ago. And it's also remarkable that the envoy sent by the Shuang Mi Xi Hou stayed very shortly, only about 4 days around this frontier area. So the second, another slips, reads, show me Xihou, or the first Xihou of the Dayue Zhi. The text is blurred, but more interesting. Although it's very broken, it says that this group of foreign guests or visitors spontaneously came to China without Han's convocation or any special occasion such as a New Year. Maybe you need a handout. Moreover, they seem to have been escorted by a Chinese captain. No. Yeah. Once they entered the common area of the Han Empire, so I translate, the Shouhou, probably a captain during a probation period named Li, but given name is not read, who is dispatched by some higher officers to escort the Shoumi Xihou of the Great Yue Zhi, who has spontaneously arrived without Han's convocation. And this is a very broken passage, but we know that the envoys, including some nobleman called Mi, and some nobleman called Mi Le Mi, and these guests, visitors, all bring with tribute for visiting the place where the emperor is staying. So not his palace, but some temporal residence, or some court or garden, we don't know. And the vehicle are to be prepared, etc. And again, there are decisions dated on 9th April 37 BCE, and the decision is very similar. And then soon, also in several days, these envoys passed the station of Xuanquan site and went eastward. So, so as we can see from this first-hand record with clear dates, we know that the Xihou in the state of the Da Yue Zhi or the Great Yue Zhi around the middle of the first century was a title or an official position recognized by Han bureaucracy. So that means they were not recognized as king as the small rulers in Sogdiana. And they enjoyed some diplomatic autonomy to some extent. And a Xihou's envoy to China was eligible to go to the emperor's temporal residence. And the formal title in Chinese protocol should be so and so Xihou of the state of Da Yue Zhi. And given this circumstance, Kuoyama suggests that Kujula's full title, or Hao, plus his own personal name in Chinese protocol before his victory should be here, Da Yue Zhi Gui Shuang Xihou Qiu Jiu Quan. Is it understandable? Okay. So these are what we know very safely about the existence of the Xihou of the Da Yue Zhi from the archaeological findings. And indeed, it can be taken as the upper limit of Kujula's emergence. But the problem is we also need to define the lower limit. And for this, Kuoyama just choose the upper end as his solution. Now we return to the whole Hanshu. Last week, I made a mistake, sorry, by telling you that the one who initially suggests to delete the character Wang from the text was Liu Bing in the 3rd century, but it's my stupid typing errors. Actually, it was my fault, and the person was in fact another one also called Liu Bing in the 1st, 11th century. And he was a scholar serving for the compilation of official history of China in his days. That means, at least until the 11th century, the character Wang was there in the manuscript, but because this phrase looked a bit strange, Liu Bing suggests to cross out it. But not every scholar agreed with him, so it was kept in the block print until the 18th century. Now, our working translation to be refined is more than 100 years later, 秋鹫雀, 西侯贵霜, attacked and destroyed the other four 西侯s and established himself as king. And his realm or state was named Kingdom of Guishuang. Here I temporarily keep Xuehe's translation, here attacked and destroyed. Thierry gives accordingly attaquai détruisé, but Chavan attaquai vainqui. For me, the verb destroy sounds very vague, and this is the word chosen by Xuehe to translate Chinese verb mie in the same paragraph, and it repeats. So, as you see, for these three different phrases of the Kushan expansion, the same verb was used to in the Hou Hanshu, and the repetance is reflected in Xuehe's and Thierry's translation, but disappeared in Hill's translation adopted by Falk. Since Kujula's victory against the other four Yabgus is not described in any sources, we have to examine his later expansion. So, first let's look into the phrase carefully. And who does not have the handout for this week? That. You should have this one with the mark of Sales Toa here. There's the last copy. Thierry translate, il envahit le royaume d'Anxi et s'empara du territoire de Gaofu. De plus, il détruisait le Puda et le Jibin et posséda entièrement ses royaumes. That means he mainly agree with Chavan's, but changes the translation of that verb by following Xuehe. In addition, you can find that Thierry wants to coordinate his punctuation with the official edition of Hou Hanshu in 1965, but cut the passage into two sentences. On the other hand, Chavan keeps the ambiguity so that you, if you just read his French, you will wonder whether Ses Royaumes should include Anxi or not. In fact, this is due to the circumstances that basically there was no punctuation in Chinese annals. So when the modern scholars provide a text reading with punctuation, it's already a text of interpretation and will at any rate reflect one's knowledge and experience. And my working attitude for this seminar is that we should punctuate the text according to the context of Hou Hanshu itself and to take Hanshu as the basic reference in order to approach what Fan Ye would have understood and what he would like to say. In other words, we should refrain from mixing modern knowledge acquired from other fields at this step. And such explanation of suggestion is to be given in footnotes and commentary instead of being straightforwardly absorbed into translation. I will explain my point later. Otherwise, the whole text edition will easily look tautological or even misleading. So now, the key word here is the adverb this one. Entièrement, entirely, fully, completely. So we must think about what the verbal phrase posséda entièrement ses royaumes actually refer to, because it contains qi here, this one, a possessive adjective, and these characters here is also widely used as a definitive pronoun and adjective. So the first step is to punctuate, and the difficulty is that here, yo, an adverb or a conjunction, so far translate variously, basically means and, again, or in addition. But following Cambridge Dictionary, one of the common usage of this word, yo, is to join two words, phrases, part of sentences, or related statement together, but not necessarily expressing a time order. So in other words, theoretically, with regard to classical Chinese grammar, one can either cut it into two sentences here as case one, or to take it as two sentences as case two. And this will, of course, result much difference in historical interpretation. Today, our official edition of Zhonghua Bookstore gives case one here, as Tiahe also adopted. No doubt because we know Anxi or Partia was always known to be a big country during the Western and Eastern Han Dynasty, and this is also the author Fan Ye learned from earlier sources. So there is no way that Kujula could ever fully occupy the Arsacid Empire, and indeed, for this reason, we can safely cut it into two sentences. Now a question arises. Although the Anxi described by Fan Ye in the Houhan Shu is evidently the Arsacid Empire in the entry specifically dealing with that empire, some modern scholars, especially Indologists and numismatists, want to emphasize that in this very passage on Da Yue Zhi, Anxi should be specially understood as Indo-Partia instead of the Arsacid so known to ancient Chinese. And this idea was first pointed out by Stankonov, a great philologist in his day, and personally I admire very much. So I just read briefly. Konov says, Anxi, as we have seen, the usual Chinese name for Partia, but here we cannot think of the Partian Empire of Ctesiphon. We have already seen from other sources in Western classics or coins, however, that Partian rulers had shortly before the beginning of our era established themselves in the Indian borderland and were menacing the Greek dominion in Kabul. Now, the immediate result of the invasion of Anxi is said to be the seizure of Kaofu or Kabul, and we necessarily infer that this Anxi must mean the Partian dynasty in the east, to which Gondovarus belonged, that means Indo-Partia. And since then, the debates begin. Sinologists like Shavan stick to the knowledge of ancient Chinese literature that Anxi invariably means Partia, but some other historians and Indologists want to revise the translation by combining it with Western classics or modern knowledge based on coins and inscriptions. Chuhye was prudent, and he did not provide any identification. As for Yu Taishan, he attempted to make a compromise so that he comments that Anxi in this passage should be specially understood as territories of Indo-Partians. Yu Taishan even proposed to take Gaofu, or the upper reach of the Kabul River in his view, as Paropamisade. This is not so precise on the old map. Here you can see Paropamisade. And in Falk's recent theory, this Paropamisade are the present Hindu Kush and the Caucasus, the Pamirs and Emodos, the Himalaya. But before linking the Chinese classic with Western classic, we have to figure out what the Chinese text would like to say from its own content. In this passage, several verbs are used to describe Kujula's expansion. So you see, qin to invade, intrude, etc. for Anxi, and qu, blah, blah, di, to take, obtain the land of Gaofu. And two verbs, mie, and xiyou, entirely have or possess, are used to state about the invasion into Pu Dynasty being simultaneously. So the first verb qing is often translated as invade. Generally, it's good and neat, but one should not forget that invade or French envahir is also ambiguous. Sometimes it can result in unnecessary misunderstanding, as TFE's critique on Kazim Abdullayev in his footnote 106 you can see in your handout. That means, for the scholars who prefer to take Anxi always as partia, the English verb invade or envahir must be taken as to enter a country with an army, this second one, without really taking control of it. Because Chinese annals never said that Anxi or Arsacid was ever controlled or occupied by any other big power during the Han Dynasty. Now, before we go into more painstaking textual analysis, let's see how Harry Fock treat this key sentence. So he gives, he invaded Anxi and took the Gaofu region. He also defeated the whole of the kingdom of Puda and Jibin. For the conquest of Gaofu or Kabul, Falk connects it with Kharoshthi inscription, which should be dated to 50 CE according to his new theory of the Azaz era in 2009. In that year, Peshawar was still ruled by Abdagazis. Here is the revised text by Stephen Baums. So you see, it was during the reign Rajami, in the Gandhari language of Avakasha, here, Avakashasa is genitive and for Abdagesis, son of the brother of the Gondopharas, Guparasa, here, Bratuputrasa. Moreover, Harry Fox draws one of Franz Kerner's theory that the Arsacid emperor Vardanes once sought for support in Western Bactria by reinterpreting it as an evidence of his campaigns against the Kushans, but Franz will comment on this later. But anyway, as a result, Falk want to add two more anchor points in the timeline that around the 40s, Kujula met or conflicted with Vardanes. But before 50 CE, Peshawar was still peaceful and safe. So, in Falk's theory, Kujula's rise was significantly late if we compare it with Kuayama's view. And in this theory, as you can see Falk text 058 in your handout, he wants to put the passage now in our question after around 30 CE. That means, in his view, the expansion could start so early and it therefore a very slow invasion. But as far as I can see, the number of the 30s is purely an estimation. And at any rate, Falk accepts a view that the situation described in the Periplus is prior to 71 CE. So he believes that, I think you can find the entry in your handout for today's Science 3. The king of those warlike Bactrian is Kujula, so it became an anchor point in his theory. Is it? I think. And please see the Greek passage, and the detail will be left later. In my eyes, in the middle 1st century AD, only two non-Chinese textual sources are precise enough to serve as anchor point, and the others collected by Harry Fock are all propositions to some degree. So let's return to the table. Thierry defends Shavan to perceive Jibin as Kashmir, while others incline to locate it in or nearby Gandhara. This also makes much difference. If Chauve and Thierry are correct on this point, then Kujula conquered a vast land. But as you can see from this map, it's the step by step from Kabul to somewhere near Peshawar and to Srinagar to Kashmir. But if Farc is correct, then Kujula's front line was generally restricted in Afghanistan and Pakistan, somehow like this. It's just a very vague sketch. And the original mark is Kabul. You see, and yellow is Puda, and green ones denote Jibin. On this map, you see better the difference. And unfortunately, Puda in Chinese sources is a hapax. That means it is attested only once in Chinese literature, and therefore very enigmatic. In fact, it was Chavan who first suggested Puda as Bactra in his review in Tongbao on Marquardt's book. And Farc prefers Paktia here. One of his main reasons is no doubt the fact that the Sanskrit form of the people living there is known to be Pakta. In my opinion, if anyone wants to solve this debate, or at least to realize where are the traps and blind points, one must return to Chinese and consider an adequate understanding of the verb mie that I just indicated, because the common translation destroy given in that passage is so vague and has opened so much space of imagination and interpretation. Thierry correctly indicate that the common meaning of mie include a more vague détruire and a stronger anéantir. Here. The basic meaning of this character as transitive verb is to extinguish a fire, or just fire, by water and or by a cover. And a dictionary compiled in the Han Dynasty explained this character by another verb, 尽, 灭, 尽也. And this verb itself basically means to make a container empty, 气中空也. So the verb 灭 therefore have many derived meaning and very common since the ancient times, including to exterminate the to destroy, to ruin, to overwhelm, to make something extinct, etc. And my point is that in classical Chinese, there are so many verbs used to describe an attack or a conquest, and I would say that to destroy fits more neatly with other verbs such as this po and huai. But this also depends on one's understanding of destroy, because this English verb again is defined variously. If we adopt Cambridge or Oxford for example, then we must act to damage what, or to put an end of the existence of what. And I would say, if you just want a very literal translation of mie to fit the etymology, then overwhelm is a good choice because it's also connected with water. Likewise, submerger can also be considered. But we also have to observe the environment, that how it was used. So during the Han, when this verb mie was collocated with zu, meaning clan, lineage, family, etc., it indeed meant to kill all the important members, or even all the members of the household. But when it collocated with guo, kingdom, state, polity, etc., that it's not necessarily so cruel. And for this, we have a lot of good examples that can be classified into the cases in pre-Han China, and the cases concerning Han's military and foreign affairs. For the cases in pre-Han China, the fixed expression is 秦灭六国 appeared very often in the Hanshu and Hohanshu concerning the unification of China by Qin Shi Huang, the first emperor of ancient China, who annexed the other six vassal states. The mode of victory were different one from another, and in some cases, his troops slaughtered citizens and soldiers for thousands of thousands, etc. Very exaggerated description. But in some cases, he just accepted the surrender peacefully. So you can consult this book, and I won't go into details. The same verb was applied to Han Dynasty's conquest of the kingdom of Eastern Yue around today's Fujian in southeast. The story was extremely long, but finally, the local king, or Wang, was murdered by a betrayer. And then, when Han troops arrived, local people were moved to another region nearby, another province of Han Empire. As for the betrayer, who was originally also an heir of the royal house, was assigned by the Han Emperor as a marquis, leading 10,000 household. And this region became empty. Another case near today's Vietnam shows that the final heir of the royal house just fled by sailing on the sea and disappeared. And then Han Empire absorbed this region to be its own commandery, I mean province, commandery, and counties. And it's interesting that there had been a prophecy by a sorcerer before this victory that the ancestors' cult inside the royal temple of this southern kingdom will be put to an end. So it concerns the sacred fire in a national temple. And here, there is another case that the Han Dynasty was just a bystander. It means the Wuhuan people to the northeast of China around here was originally called Donghu, that means Eastern Xiongnu. Their realm was overwhelmed by the Xiongnu, so that the rest of land took refuge in the Wuhuan Mountains and therefore took it as their new name. But their original realm is extinguished or overwhelmed. So, in summary, when Mie is used to describe the destruction of a polity, it would mean to make its local royal house extinct, or at least having no valid claimants, and to occupy most of its territory, but not necessarily a grand massacre or large-scale destruction or great fires that could leave traces on archaeological sites. Moreover, the case of Qin Shi Huang's unification of China and then Western Han's expansion means that some members of the old ruling class can survive. But these cases also show that an important result is the replacement of currency, measure units, and era and calendar. In fact, Qin Shi Huang unified the measure system as soon as he annexed the last kingdom in the same year, but it is after 10 years that he finally unified the currency system inside the empire. We do not know how quickly Kujula would make similar policies during his expansion, but he must have need some time to stabilize his new territory. Now let's look into the Kushan invasion toward India by Kujula's successor, most likely Vima Takto, that Fan Ye would mean, or a confusion of Vima Takto and Vima Kadphises. So Thierry translate, à plus de 80 ans, Qiu Jiu chue mourut. Et son fils Yan Gaozhen le remplaça sur le trône. À son tour, il détruisit l'Inde et établit comme général l'un de ses hommes pour la gouverner. Here, Thierry follows Chavan to take Tianzhu, or old Chinese somehow sounding like Tiantok, as India. But given the content of the whole Hanshu, it's also possible to conceive it as the Indus River Plain. So So there is again divergence of translation, and Yu Taishan take it and translate it, but adding a comment very vague that Li Tianzhu refers to the destruction and occupation for some time of the Hellenic kingdom in certain areas in the valley of the Indus by Yan Gaozhen, namely Vimatakto. This at least reflects Yu Taishan's idea that Tianzhu here more likely refers to the Indus plain rather than the whole India. But this is an open question, and especially when we consider whether it's possible or not to conquer the vast India in only one generation. At any rate, I think the spatial compound verb, jianling, here cannot be ignored. Although it is translated gouverner or control and is acceptable, these verbs are also often used to match more common and simple verbs like zhi, this one. So we must think why here a compound was used. And so far, only Hill's translation reflects its nature as a compound. Moreover, the text only says a general or a man as general, but here he translates comme général l'un des saisons, which seems too much because theoretically, Kujula may assign this position to a local noble, not necessarily his own fellow. So to solve this problem, we again have to take a content analysis. In Hanshu and Hou Hanshu, there are 7 or 8 attestations of this compound verb. It combines jian here to inspect or supervise, and ling to direct or lead. Its usage, as far as I can see, is usually related to a spatial mission and collocated with some official titles from central court or imperial palace or from a military office, so including Shi Zhe, Ye Zhe, Jiang, General, and Jiao Wei or Xiao Wei, Commandant. So again, I divided the case into internal affairs and foreign affairs. For the internal affairs of the China, there are 2 cases. The first case I just summarized, that the Eastern Han court appointed Deng Xun to supervise and direct a new project of canalization in Central Asia. In the second case, it says that the court appointed Yu Linglang, a military officer, to supervise and direct an imperial grassland, also inside Central China. For the foreign affairs, but actually concerning the relationship between the Han Empire and its dependency, there is one attestation, which infers a military control combined with diplomatic delegation. So, the Western Han court established an office of Hu Wuhuan Xiao Wei, literally the commandant protecting the Wuhuan on this northeastern frontier, in the Wuhuan stand, and the officer's duty was to supervise and lead the Wuhuan people by holding the stock. That means this officer was appointed also as a diplomatic envoy in order to keep them from secretly contacting the Xiongnu to the north here of the empire. So you can take this officer as a office as a kind of protectorate to the northeast of China, but its rank is lower than the one established in the Tarim Basin here. Another case does not deal directly with Chinese Empire, but dealing with the internal affair of the nomadic Xiongnu itself. And so the Supreme Khagan of the Southern Xiongnu in Inner Mongolia, and in that time hostile to Eastern Han, dispatched the 2 high-rank nobles to inspect and lead the soldiers in the tribe or in the division of his nephew named B, and this B later really betrayed. And so in this case, these two nobles undertook intelligence of surveillance to control internal rebellion. But there is again another case which reflects this verbal compound can even be used to state a non-Chinese state's international affairs, namely ancient Korea and its new dependency. So, during the Eastern Han, the state of Goli, future Korea, around here, today's North Korea, made Wozhu dependency, and Wozhu is on the seashore around here. The Goli kingdom dispatched its Zhongdaren, literally middle rank of Grand Master, from its court as envoys, Shizhe, in order to supervise, inspect, and lead the realm of Wozhu near the sea, to impose tax there such as marten furs, fishes, salt, seafood, and to collect beauties as female servants, etc. So I think the three cases about Wuhuan, Xiongnu, and ancient Korea are all inspiring. They help to justify Tiehe's translation. Also, what he fulfilled in the sentence should be put in brackets. And these three cases also help us to explore the model of Kushan governance in India. We know that in Hou Han Shu, a kingdom far away in eastern India was demanded by the Kushans to offer labor service and taxes. But it is obscure whether such control had been established as early as in the days of Bhima Takto. And this is to be answered from archaeological and numismatic evidence. At any rate, to draw an outline of the career of Kujula and his son, there are three phases. Each usage of Mie is further connected by other phrases to explain the actual situation. And it's under this different environment that we can interpret them as formation of kingdoms as phase one, and annexing other polities including Puda and Jibin as the phase two, perhaps as new province, but we don't know. And the next phase by his son Yan Gaozhen is to conquer further, maybe as dependencies and even establishing a military headquarters. Now we are finally ready to treat the table and the Puda and Jibin annexed by Kujula. Nowadays, one thing has been clear is that Jibin did not mean Kashmir in Han times. Such a denotion is later around the 5th century and does not conform with the period in our discussion. In the Han period, Jibin just be a region in or very close to Gandhara, and it was on a very vast plain. So, for our working translation, Kujula invaded Anxi and took or seized the land of Gaofu. And moreover, he put an end to the royal houses of Puda and Jibin and completely possessed their realms. Or more concisely, he annexed Puda and Jibin. The first thing to be noticed is that this phrase itself meant to be an update with regard to the state of kingdom of Jibin in the Han Shu. It was famous that Jibin was one of a few foreign polities who dared to kill Chinese envoys sent by the emperors. And it should be punished, but situated too far away. And in the Hou Han Shu, there was no such entry because when the Eastern Han Chinese heard about it again, it had been conquered. A close look into the Han Shu reveals that a Jibin king submit his apology to Han again here, at some in some year between 33 and 22 BC, but it was again rejected by a Chinese emperor. Falk does not analyze this story so carefully, but in fact, it's clear that Jibing was still an independent kingdom around 30 BC or even 20 BC, and this can be taken as another anchor point. Now, what was Gao Fu? Gao Fu, as Fan Ye wanted to update, was a semi-independent country. And let's read Thierry's translation, because Chavan's is not good. Le royaume de Gao Fu est situé au sud-ouest de Kong Yue Zhi. C'est également un grand pays. Ses mœurs et ses coutumes sont identiques à celles de l'Inde, ils sont faibles et faciles à assujettir. Il est excellent dans le commerce et les échanges, et les fortunes privées sont immenses. Le Gao Fu a été soumis par différents maîtres. Trois pays, l'Inde, le Jibing et l'Anxi, ont successivement eu assez de puissance pour le prendre, mais successivement, en raison de leur affaiblissement, ils l'ont perdu. Ils n'avaient encore jamais subi la domination de Yue Zhi. Le Hanshu le compte parmi les cinq Shihou, mais cela n'est pas conforme à la réalité. La dernière domination est celle de l'Anxi. C'est à partir du moment où les Yue Zhi vainquirent l'Anxi que débute leur domination sur le Gao Fu. Here I would remark that Gao Fu later became a dependency of Anxi or Arsaci before Kujula's invasion, and Thierry's translation, la dernière domination, here is too much and very conjectural. That is to say, to Fan Ye's knowledge, Gao Fu once or for several times became a dependency of Anxi before Kujula's invasion, but the date was obscure to Fan Ye. It is interesting that he stated Gao Fu as a big country, Da Guo, and this recalls the same word used for Su Yi or Sogdiana in Tongdian at the same time, about the same time. So I think it perhaps denotes a free trade zone formed by some commercial settlements or even a town or city-states. I know some readers like Stamkonov insist that from numismatic evidence or sources in Western classic, here Anxi can only be Indo-Parthia. And I'm not rejecting this opinion, but we must understand that the information known to Fan Ye was fragmentary and uncontinuous. What we knew was that Anxi was Arsacid and Arsacid was Anxi. There would have been no much difference in his eyes, nor in the eyes of Han Chinese concerning the difference between Arsaci Parthia and its frontier provinces later become more independent. So, under this circumstance, also Fan Ye tried his best to organize all the available data and compose the text like a narrative. His writing no doubt makes something really true with something fulfilled or imagined by himself, or something too much simplified when he had to make a concise writing. So when we read Ho Han Shu, we must be prudent to distinguish a part being safer from a part being more dangerous and dubious. Now, concerning the situation of Gao Fu among Yue Zhi, Jibing, Anxi, and Tianzhu, the text gives us two theoretical possibilities. Either Gao Fu was among four polities, countries, but never subordinated by Yue Zhi, or Gao Fu was among the three, and later conquered by Yue Zhi. And anyway, before Kujala's rise, Gao Fu was at least once under the command of the Arsacid. And the problem is that there is no Puda in this important sentence, and Puda is a hapax. To analyze this problem, we must go back to the Han Shu about the former Han, which Fan Ye liked to refer to. So, in the Han Shu, in the entry on the Da Yue Zhi, the geographical situation is that Ji Bing was situated to the south of Da Yue Zhi and was on a plain, and Anxi was very far away, about 49 days maybe of horse riding. And then when we read the entry on Ji Bing in the Han Shu, it says that the situation is more detailed. Yue Zhi was to the northwest of Ji Bing, and to the southwest of Ji Bing, there is a kingdom called Wuyi Shanli, or Alexandria, and now scholars take it as Alexandria of Arachosia. Then, in the entry on Wuyi Shanli again in the Han Shu, this kingdom was clearly defined as a terminus of southern road of China to its west, situated between Ji Bing to its east, Putao or Putiao to its north, and Anxi to its west. And this Putiao is against a hapax. So, to combine all such information together, the image given by Han Shu is like this. Can you see? And what Fan Ye want to update and revise in his whole Han Shu is about the situation beyond Gandhara to the south, that there is Tianzhu, and it is another name of the Shendu in Shiji. And Shendu just means Indus in the context of Shiji. The Indus River Plain. And moreover, Fan Ye want to add that there is the big country called Gaofu between Anxi, Ji Bing, and Tianzhu. And moreover, Alexandria during the Eastern Han changed its name to Paichi, but we know that this is most likely a scribble error for Paite, as this form was attested in a text around the same period, around the 3rd century in Wei Lue. But still, there is no definition of Puda. So, to solve this problem, scholars generally equate the hapax Putao or Putiao in Han Shu with the hapax Puda in Ho Han Shu. It is for this geographical situation that Shavans want to take it as Bactra, and so adopted by Yu Taishan. Fuxi's opinion has been rejected by Dafina, and I won't go into details today. But I think we should, one should consider the possibility that Fan Ye, or the Chinese earlier than him, just confused all the toponyms that sounds more or less similar. The main subject behind this transcription no doubt involves with the rise of Indo-Parthia on the eastern frontier of Arsacid Empire, but Fan Ye was unable to make it more clear. So, among them, the Paite was once identified by Sun Yutang, he was teacher of Yu Taishan, with Prophetasia, and this may be open to discussion. So, as my final slide today, I would assume such a process of confusion like this. Maybe that at some stage, Putiao was used to mark Alexandria, maybe Drangiana or Bactria, as Shavan want to suggest it, I don't know. And Wuyi Shanli means Alexandria around Arakosya, and somehow it was all confused by Fan Ye or his earlier predecessors that it just sounds like Pai Te and even Pu Da, and there must be something being confused between Pak Tia and all other toponyms. And of course, we can discuss whether this Proptasia was preserved so late into Chinese text or not. Yeah, I think this is my part.
But maybe we can keep this slide at the moment. Je vais faire quelques commentaires sur la toponymie et les identifications possibles d'un point de vue philologique. Bon, après, donc, pour compléter ce que Zhao Zhong a présenté d'un point de vue, disons, I'll come to my power. Ok, on est une demi-heure. J'essaie de ne pas dépasser. Oui, il y a la discussion de ces toponymes soulève quelques problèmes, enfin, notamment la discussion telle qu'elle est menée par nos collègues chinois. Plusieurs points. Bon, il y a des choses assez convaincantes. Voilà. Le mystérieux Pu Tiao Pu Da, qui est vraiment très très problématique. Il me semble que il faut faire l'économie du rapprochement avec ce toponyme grec Proftasia, donc Alexandre. Pour résumer, Alexandre a fondé parmi les Alexandries une Alexandrie Proftasia qui voudrait dire l'Alexandrie du pressentiment, l'Alexandrie, parce que c'est là où il a déjoué un complot. Bien. C'est connu uniquement par les sources sur la conquête d'Alexandre. On ne sait pas exactement où c'est, quelque part en Inde du Nord-Ouest, dans ses conquêtes indiennes. Et on ne voit pas du tout comment ça aurait pu survivre ultérieurement dans la toponymie. Donc, je pense que Proftasia, c'est à éliminer. Bien. Maintenant, c'est sûr que si on prend Pu Da, je laisse Pu Tiao de côté. Donc, Pu Da, ça me paraissait très douteux, mais enfin, il est certain que le rapport avec le Pak Tia me posait un gros problème, mais phonétiquement, quand même, c'est assez tentant parce que une des transcriptions, disons, ancien chinoise de Pu Da, c'est Pok Tiu, qui ressemble quand même énormément à Pak Tia. Alors, voilà. Finalement, Pak Tia serait mon favori. Une conquête qui est mentionnée là, absolument pas un pays de grande importance, mais c'est mentionné là parce que, dans la logique, venant après Gao Fu qui semble être Kaboul, c'est une extension possible vers le sud. Oui, la région de Gardez, oui, c'est-à-dire on n'est pas loin du Dashtinaour. En même temps, voilà, donc on atteint là ce qui plus tard va apparaître comme la frontière sud-ouest des Kouchans sous Vimataktou. Ça paraît logique. Alors j'ai un petit problème quand même avec les formes des mots. Kipin n'est pas Cachemire, on est d'accord. Le Cachemire n'apparaît dans le paysage qu'à partir de Vimataktou plus tard. Donc, exit Cachemire. Alors maintenant, l'interprétation préférée, c'est le Gandhara. Bien. Le problème est que je ne vois pas comment rapprocher la forme Kipin du Gandhara. Alors que, il me semble superficiellement que Kapisa, qui est le nom généralement préféré dans l'Antiquité pour le pays au nord de Kaboul, irait mieux.
Alors, regarde, it was first suggested by Shiratori, yeah. And he explained it as the another transcription of Kabul, Kopen, and Kipin.
Kipin Kabul. Oui, oui, mais à ce moment-là, oui, keeping Kabul. Kapisa would be better. Kapisa, because we have keeping, we have K, and we have B, B. Kapisa. But again, Gaofu phonétiquement can be Kabul. I come back to that now. Je vais revenir là-dessus. Mais, bon, voilà, c'est quand même... On cherche le Gandhara ici et on a un peu du mal à le trouver parce que phonétiquement, aucune de ces formes transmises ne reflète la forme Gandhara qui est tout de même bien établie depuis l'époque achéménide. Donc là, il y a quand même un problème. Je continue avec la question de... can we see again the... oui, Woody Shanley, etc. Yala, voilà. Alors, un point d'accrochage assez bon dans ces cartes, c'est ça. C'est donc Ansi, la qui aurait une double signification. Ansi, ça transcrit en chinois Arshak, c'est-à-dire le nom de la dynastie qui règne sur les Parthes. Et là, on nous parle de 49 jours, c'est précis, hein, 49 jours à cheval entre le pays des Yuezhi et la capitale de Ansi. Ça nous met à peu près à 3000 km. Journée de cheval. 2-3 000 km. La journée de cheval, je pense d'après les calculs, on arrive à, c'est à peu près 4. On estime la moyenne à peu près 80 km par jour.
Oui, enfin, il faut faire attention parce que si, c'est pas du tout la même chose si on est en une poste rapide, on
fait
des chevaux tous les 20 km, etc. Et si on parle 80, c'est énorme.
Enfin, oui, mais ça, c'est pas. Il est, oui, en même temps, oui, c'est énorme, mais a priori, dans ce genre d'estimation, on peut penser plutôt à des informations fournis par des envoyés et des ambassadeurs. Or, on sait, par les textes que nous avions analysés sur le Kangqiu, montrent que les ambassadeurs, on les faisait voyager vite. On n'avait pas très envie qu'ils traînent et regardent un peu à gauche et à droite. On les faisait voyager par la poste rapide. Donc, 49 jours, 2-3 000 km, bah, ça peut nous amener dans les capitales parthes, effectivement, Ctésiphon, etc. Or, on a au moins un témoignage sur une ambassade. Les ambassades entre les Yuezhi et les Parthes, on ne les connaît pas, mais elles ont certainement existé. Entre les Chinois et les Parthes, on a un témoignage. C'est lorsque, je ne sais plus quelle année... vers 40, les envoyés chinois ont été envoyés à la capitale des Parthes, sont arrivés sur les bords du golfe Persique et voulaient continuer pour aller chez les Romains, dont ils avaient entendu parler. C'est en quelle année, Chao Zhong, cette affaire on leur a dit, les Parthes leur ont dit, oh là là, non, non, avant d'atteindre le Tatsin, enfin la Chine, ou le Fulin, il y a des océans à franchir, c'est extrêmement dangereux, c'est très long. En réalité, ils leur mentaient parce qu'ils ne voulaient pas que les Chinois établissent des relations commerciales directes avec l'Empire romain. Donc là, je dirais que ces 49 jours, ça sonne comme quelque chose d'authentique. Et ça nous mettrait, effectivement, ça voudrait dire que ici, dans ce contexte, Annecy, c'est bien l'Empire des Arsacides, dont la capitale est à Ctésiphon. Oui, peut-être Ramadan, peut-être Ecbatane, voilà, à l'ouest de l'Iran. Mais dans les autres contextes vus ici, quand il s'agit de Annecy, qui à un certain moment a contrôlé Gaofu, c'est évidemment ce que les auteurs chinois ont en tête, c'est l'extension de l'empire arsacide, c'est-à-dire l'empire des Indopartes, qui, disons, ça commence en fait avec Gondopharès, qu'on situe maintenant à partir de 30 après Jésus-Christ. Donc, il faut savoir que quand on parle de Hansi, ça peut être l'empire parthe. Dans des textes plus tardifs, ça veut dire Merv. Le grand centre le plus sur la frontière orientale de l'empire parthe, mais ça peut vouloir dire aussi le royaume des Indo-Parthes qui s'affichait lui-même comme affilié aux Parthes, le nomastique des souverains, leur régalia, leur symbolique indique que ces gens-là se considéraient comme des représentants ou des alliés de l'Empire parthe. Bien. Alors, maintenant, Wei Shanli, ça c'est intéressant, parce que là, on arrive à quelque chose de très précis. Wei Shanli... children, can we come to my own PowerPoint, yeah. The first image? Voilà. Toponymie. Voilà. Après, je vais revenir sur les autres mots. Wei Shanli... C'est certainement, ça le premier qui l'a compris, je crois, c'est Peul et Blanc, c'est Alexandrie. En transcription en moyen chinois, transcription Carlgren, il y en a d'autres, hein, j'ai pris celle-là, Wu Yuxianlie, qui ressemble quand même beaucoup à Alexandria. Et c'est généralement considéré comme Alexandrie d'Arakosi, c'est-à-dire aujourd'hui Kandahar. Bien. Et une donnée qui corrobore cela et qui n'a, en fait, je crois, pas été introduite dans la discussion. Elle l'est par le numismate Pankaj Tandon. C'est que, à partir du Huangshu, le mot Wei Shanli est remplacé par Paichi. Paichi. Et on sait maintenant, par la numismatique, que précisément à partir du IIIe siècle, s'est créé dans cette zone frontalière entre, au moment de l'effondrement et de l'Empire parthe et de l'Empire couchant, s'est créé un royaume indépendant qui s'appelle le royaume des Paratha, les Parataraja, c'est les Paradanes dans les inscriptions sassanides. C'est un royaume qui allait de Kandahar à Quetta et qui donc contrôlait les passes entre les vallées donc du sud de l'Afghanistan et la vallée de l'Indus. Et il est extrêmement tentant, je crois que c'est Tandom l'avait dit, que Paich soit en fait le royaume des Paratha, et ça explique très bien pourquoi à partir du Huangshu, on n'entend plus parler d'Alexandrie dans cette zone, mais c'est remplacé par ce mot-là. Donc là, on a quelque chose d'assez précis, hein, un bon point d'accrochage. Bon, maintenant, suite des considérations sur la toponymie. Kaboul. Alors, moi, je continue à penser que Keeping, ça ressemble quand même à Kapisa, qui est le nom historique de la zone région de Kaboul depuis l'époque achéménide, c'est le nom indien, connu tardivement. Bien. Il faut savoir que la capitale historique de cette région, c'est pas Kaboul. Hein. Kaboul n'émerge vraiment, semble-t-il, qu'à partir de l'époque des Heftalites. Avant ça, ou peut-être des Kouchanos sassanites, plutôt les Heftalites. La capitale historique de la région de Kaboul, c'est plus au nord, c'est Bégram, qui s'appelle Kapisi. Bien. Alors, s'il s'agit vraiment de Kaboul, si Gaofu est vraiment Kaboul, effectivement, ça pourrait faire rappeler le nom grec de la ville de Kaboul, qui est connue par Ptolémée, Kaboura. Mais et par ailleurs, on a le nom de la rivière de Kaboul, en sanskrit Kuba, en grec, mais ça c'est pas chez Ptolémée, c'est chez Strabon, Kophès. Alors, est-ce que Kaboura est une variante de Kuba? Semblerait que oui, c'est possible. C'est possible. Donc, éventuellement, effectivement, il n'y a pas d'impossibilité phonétique que Gaofu soit Kaboul, mais j'ai quand même une objection historico-géographique, c'est que Kaboul n'est pas à ce moment-là la capitale de la région. Et que la capitale de la région, c'est Kapisi, c'est qui ressemblerait plus à Kipin. Voilà, ça c'est le problème que je me pose maintenant. Pour Dranjana, on ne va pas en parler maintenant parce que on va revenir là-dessus. Enfin, disons, voilà, le royaume indo-parthe se forme à partir d'une région au sud-est de l'Afghanistan, le sud-ouest de l'Afghanistan, qui est anciennement la Drangiane, hein, ancienne perse Dranka. Forme est-iranienne Dranka, puisqu'on a la variante phonétique. Le nom survit aujourd'hui, c'est la capitale du Sistan, la capitale de la province iranienne du Sistan, qui s'appelle Zaranj. Bien. Mais pour le nom du pays, ça a été remplacé par Sakastan, qui est aujourd'hui Sistan, et c'est après la migration des peuples Saka, sans doute à la fin du IIe siècle avant notre ère. Alors, voilà sur la toponymie, je dirais, par rapport à ce qui a été présenté par Chao Zhong, je suis convaincu par beaucoup de choses. Je pense que Wuyi Shanli devenu Parada est un très bon point d'accrochage géographique. J'ai toujours un problème avec Gaofu et Kipin. Bien. Alors, la suite. Alors, ce que je voulais dire maintenant, de plusieurs points, par rapport à la bibliographie que j'ai indiquée la semaine dernière, il y a un titre qui m'avait échappé, enfin, que j'ai connu seulement après, parce que l'article m'a été envoyé par l'auteur, c'est cet article de Joe Crib, Numismatic Evidence and the Date of Kanishka, qui est paru en 2018, dans un volume extrêmement intéressant, Problème de chronologie dans l'art du Gandhara, parce que c'est le premier volume, c'est le premier colloque où on a pris comme base la nouvelle chronologie Falk, avec la redatation de l'ère d'Azès vers 48 avant Jésus-Christ et la redatation la datation maintenant solide de l'ère de Kanishka en 127, et on a repris la question des œuvres datées de l'art du Gandhara. Et c'est vraiment c'est un tournant dans l'étude chronologique de l'art du Gandhara. Alors il se trouve que dans ce volume, Crib donne un tableau actualisé par rapport à ce qui avait été donné dans son article de 2014 et aussi dans ce qui est donné dans le volume Kushan Histories, des points d'accrochage qu'on a maintenant pour les règnes des Kushans et au-delà hein, des grands Kushans, puisqu'il va jusqu'au Kushano-Sassanide, il indique ici, très commodément, toutes les inscriptions datées d'après les ères, les deux ères où on les trouve, les trois ères, l'ère grecque, l'ère d'Azès, l'ère de Kanishka, donc l'ère d'Azès d'abord, puis l'ère grecque, puis l'ère de Kanishka, à partir de Kanishka, en donnant les équivalents dans notre calendrier. Il y a deux inscriptions hypothétiques. Hein. Pour Vimataktou, il envoie une en 96, mais c'est probable, mais le souverain n'est pas nommé. C'est un couchant, il pense que ce couchant en 96, ça ne peut être que Vimataktou, mais il n'est pas nommé. Et puis, pour Vimakatfisès, c'est un peu pareil, en 113, il y a un couchant, hein, mais il n'est pas nommé non plus. Mais voilà. Pour le reste, disons, dans le système de Crib, qui n'aurait certainement pas encore aujourd'hui été accepté par Gérard Foussman, mais qui a l'adhésion de Harry Falk, c'est aujourd'hui le tableau le plus précis. Bien. Alors, est-ce que j'ai un peu de temps? J'ai encore un petit peu de temps pour parler d'un... deux sources occidentales qui sont assez intéressantes pour la chronologie des premiers couchants. On n'a vraiment pas beaucoup de sources occidentales intéressantes pour la chronologie des premiers couchants. On a une indication, on va en reparler plus tard, qu'en 124 avant Jésus-Christ, donc au moment même où les Yuezhi viennent d'arriver dans la Bactrie, au nord de la Bactriane, un roi parthe, Artaban I, est mort en les combattant. On reviendra là-dessus. Dans la source qui en parle, c'est-à-dire, c'est dans Justin, on dit qu'il meurt en combattant les Tokaroi, qui est le nom que les sources grecques donnent plus tard aux Yuechi. Ça indiquerait qu'au moment où ils arrivent, avant de s'être peut-être stabilisés sur ces territoires au nord de la Bactriane, les Yuechi sont des gens mobiles qui font des raids, qui les poussent parfois très à l'ouest, et ça les amène à rencontrer le roi parthe et à le tuer en bataille. Ça, c'est l'unique indication que nous avons, et ça, c'est quand même assez intéressant. C'est l'unique indication que nous avons que les Yuechi et les Kushans auraient pu parfois se trouver en relation d'hostilité avec l'Empire parthe. Parce qu'il n'y a pas d'autre indication. On a l'impression, on ne nous parle jamais après ça, de guerre entre les Parthes et les Kushans. Les guerres à l'Est avec l'Empire, les guerres entre Iraniens et derniers Kushans, ça recommence au moment de l'arrivée des Sassanides en 230. Avant ça, on ne parle pas de guerre. L'hypothèse que je fais, qui est une hypothèse personnelle, c'est que les Parthes, les Arsacides et les Kushans s'entendaient pour la gestion de la route de la soie. Et donc avaient une espèce d'accord selon lequel la liberté du commerce ne devait pas être menacée. Et que c'est l'ambition des Sassanides de tout contrôler qui les a amenés à lancer les hostilités. Ça, c'est une hypothèse personnelle. On a un incident intéressant, enfin, voilà, 42, 48, plutôt 45, 48. On a ce texte chez Tacite, visiblement extrêmement bien informé, qui nous parle d'une alliance, semble-t-il, conclue entre un souverain parthe et un souverain couchant. Et c'est bien daté, parce que ce roi parthe, Vardan Ier, on sait exactement quand il est. Alors Vardan Ier, c'est mon identification. C'est reproduit dans le volume Kushan Histories, et j'aurais dû mieux contrôler les épreuves, parce que Harry Falk m'a fait dire ce que je n'écrivais pas. C'est-à-dire les campagnes du parthe Vardan Ier contre les couchants. Non, c'est pas des campagnes contre, c'est une alliance. Bien, alors, je ne peux pas lire le texte d'après. Attendez, non, il est dans le handout. Ouais. Oui, voilà. Alors, je prends. Alors, j'ai publié ça en russe. Donc, pour le moment, la seule carte qui existe exprimant mon idée, elle est en russe. Tacite nous dit que le roi Vardan Ier, le roi des Parthes Vardan Ier prend le pouvoir en 42. Comme d'habitude, il a un frère à qui lui dispute le trône. Ce frère est gouverneur des provinces orientales, c'est Gotarzès. Donc Gotarzès qui s'appuie sur les Hyrcaniens, c'est-à-dire la province actuelle du Gorgane, hein, et les Dars. Alors, vaguement, les nomades qui sont plus au nord et au nord-est. Appuyés sur ces gens-là, il contraint Vardan à abandonner la capitale, c'est le Si. Et là, qu'est-ce qu'on nous dit ? Vardan installa sa cour de l'autre côté, dans les plaines des Bactriens. Et c'est la seule fois. Bactrien, on peut dire, bon, ah, c'est général, ça peut dire vaguement, quelque part à l'est. Eh bien non, parce que c'est la seule fois où Tacite nous parle des Bactriens. Et l'hypothèse que j'ai formulée, c'est que quand il dit Bactrien, ça veut dire les couchants. Et on a un indice pour corroborer. En 127, retenez bien la date, 127-128, c'est la date de l'avènement de Kanishka. On va revenir là-dessus plus tard. L'empereur Adrien, séjournant en Syrie du Nord, reçoit une ambassade des rois des Bactriens. Et l'hypothèse qui a été faite par l'historien, le grand historien d'Adrien, Birdley, c'est que cette ambassade des rois de Bactriens en 128 après Jésus-Christ, c'est une ambassade de Kanishka auprès de Adrien pour faire reconnaître son avènement. Et le fait qu'il, qu'il institue une nouvelle ère, etc. Donc, Bactrien, ça peut se lire comme couchant. Bien. Alors, je vais dire tout de suite, j'ai une corroboration iconographique à ça, mais on en parlera plus tard. C'est les reliefs de Khalchayan qui, à mon avis, représentent des combats frontaliers de souverains couchants, de princes couchants, quel contrat des peuples de type Saka en armure de leur type. Je pense que c'est des guerres frontalières avec les Kangkyu, ou peut-être plus à l'ouest. Et dans la scène où on voit la cour, on a les souverains Yuechi, on a une princesse, une jeune princesse, et on a un roi parthe. Ça, on a toujours compris que c'était un roi parthe. Mon hypothèse, c'est que c'est Vardhan, réfugié à la cour des Bactriens, qui noue une alliance, et donc ça expliquerait la suite. C'est que une contre-offensive amena Vardhan sur la rivière Erindes. Erindes, c'est la rivière de Gorgan, ici. Donc, il attaque son frère dans ce qui auparavant, son frère qui l'a chassé du trône, dans ce qui auparavant était son apanage. Après un sévère combat, complète victoire, donc il reprend le pouvoir, et là il revient à l'est, et il soumet les tribus qui s'étendent jusqu'à la frontière entre les Da et les Ariens. Ariens, ici, à cette date, ça veut dire la province de l'Ari, c'est-à-dire Herat. Bien, c'est donc la rivière du Tedjen. C'est pourquoi j'ai montré ici une scène de combat. J'en ai montré une là, j'en ai montré une là. Donc Vardhan revient et il arrive à soumettre les Da jusqu'à la frontière ici. Et l'hypothèse que j'ai faite, c'est que il n'y a pas grand-chose en fait maintenant entre lui et les couchants. Il y a Merv qui semble à l'époque occupée par une branche des Indocites. Ou peut-être déjà non, en fait ce sont déjà des c'est pas les Indopartes, c'est des gens qui leur sont affiliés, bon, et que voilà, on aurait donc là peut-être une alliance entre les couchants et les Partes pour soumettre par des opérations communes cette zone qui s'étend donc entre l'Empire parthe naissant, dont la frontière, l'Empire couchant naissant, dont la frontière est à peu près ici, et l'extrémité orientale atteinte par le roi parthe qui est ici. Il n'y a donc pas grand-chose entre les deux. Alors, je dis tout de suite, pour moi c'est un bon point d'accrochage, parce qu'on est en 45-47 de notre ère, sur les reliefs de Khalchayan, on voit un vieux roi, Yuechi, sur son trône, et un jeune prince qui visiblement est le héros des scènes. C'est lui qui, semble-t-il, a mené les combats contre peut-être les Kangkyu. Il tient une armure en trophée. Il est assez jeune, mais ça peut être un homme un homme d'âge moyen. Il, depuis longtemps, on a constaté qu'il avait exactement la même tête que le premier qui a battu Monet avec le mot couchant, c'est-à-dire Héraos. Dans mon hypothèse, en 45-48, qu'est-ce qui va bien avec la chronologie que nous acceptons maintenant? Eh bien, c'est que, je reviens sur le début, la généalogie, voilà, c'est que ce jeune roi, qui est en train de succéder à son père âgé, eh bien, c'est Kujula Katfises. Et c'est lui qui a accueilli le prétendant Partvardhan à sa cour, à la suite de quoi il y a peut-être eu une alliance pour des opérations communes contre des peuples Saka ou Indos qui se trouvaient à l'ouest. Ce serait donc les reliefs de Khalchayan, dont je reparlerai plus tard, commémoreraient les circonstances glorieuses de l'avènement. De l'avènement de Kujula Katfises. J'ajoute une chose, Khalchayan, c'est seulement à 80 km au sud-ouest d'Almansi, là où nous supposons que se trouve le tombeau de Vimataktou, fils de Kujula Katfises. On est donc là dans des zones qui, encore à cette époque des deux premiers souverains couchants, sont considérés par eux comme vital, comme vraiment comme le cœur de leur domination. Voilà. Bon, ben j'en ai fini pour aujourd'hui, et donc la prochaine fois on va continuer sur la même ligne. Do I speak alone next time or do you
speak alone. Hein?
You speak again. Ok.
Hein?
Ok, je commencerai par une présentation de la question Vimataktou Sotermegas, d'après les dernières données, et puis Chao Jong reprendra la parole. Voilà. Je termine parce qu'une chose qui a été dite là, mais ce n'était pas dans le handout. Il y a une autre source occidentale qui nous parle des premières conquêtes des couchants. C'est le périple de la mer Érythrée, source grecque compilée à Alexandrie. Peut-être approximativement, certains disent c'est précis, d'autres disent que ça ne l'est pas, vers 70 de notre ère, et qui dit que en Inde, les Bactriens sont un peuple très puissant qui est en train d'envahir l'Inde du Nord. Les Bactriens. Quand on dit les Bactriens, moi je lis les couchants, et on est en 70. Si on est en 70, on est exactement au moment où Kujula Katfises est en train de dominer le Gandhara, le Kapisa, etc. Bon, ça, ce sont les seules sources qu'on a, mais on peut aussi bien donc la notice sur le roi Partvardhan que cette indication du périple s'intègre assez bien avec les chronologies que nous pouvons adopter maintenant d'après les inscriptions et les monnaies. Voilà, alors je vous dis donc à la semaine prochaine.
Retrouvez tous les contenus du Collège de France sur www.college-de-france.fr.